did his early education in Brazil and then got a PhD from Caltech in quantum field theory. And then he did for several years work in theoretical X-ray physics before turning to foundational questions, which he's been working on for about 15 years. And he's worked on the foundations of inference, on things like the question of prior selection in Bayesian probability theory, and on providing a unified basis for Bayesian probability theory and maximum entropy. And he's also worked extensively on foundations of physics, on the reconstruction of quantum theory, and also classical dynamics, starting from entropic ideas. So today he'll be talking about the quantum theory part of that, on deriving quantum theory of entropic dynamics. Thank you.
Well, first, thanks, Philip, for the invitation to spend a few weeks here. I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of fun. As Philip mentioned, I'm going to be talking about entropic dynamics and how one can get quantum mechanics out of it. So the question that I'm actually interested, the big picture question that I'm kind of thrilled by is, do the laws of physics reflect laws of nature directly, or whether they actually are, the laws of physics are a little bit more indirectly connected to nature through they being just rules or information about nature. This may sound a little bit weird when one first hears about it, but one must bear in mind that there are laws of physics, namely laws of statistical mechanics and thermodynamics, that can be derived from entropic arguments. So we do have an example already that seems to be working. So the question for me is, and this is the objective for the talk, to derive quantum theory as examples, as an example of entropic inference. The crucial point, of course, is going to be what kind of assumptions one needs to make, and whether one gains interesting insights into quantum mechanics. So this is my one slide summary of entropic inference. This is the way it works. This is the space of all probability distributions. And that's a prior. That prior probability distribution reflects whatever I know about the variable x before I acquire information about it. The information is in the form of a constraint. So what this is telling me is that, I love this Canadian approach to pointers. This means is that if my original probability distribution is there, and now I am told that I should update my probability distribution somewhere over there, the big problem is that I have to make a decision as to which one I pick there, which probability distribution I pick. The procedure to do this is to rank all probability distributions here according to the relative entropy of the probability distribution P, any point there, relative to the prior, and that's the expression you use. Now, why this expression? How you justify the use of this particular form of the entropy as opposed to any other you come up with? That's a subject for quite another lecture. But this is quite unique in that what's happening here is that I'm ranking these probability distributions accordingly, according to how close they are to the prior. The dominating feature here is that when I update from a prior to a posterior, I want to preserve as much information as possible that's contained in the prior, presumably because this prior was obtained as a result of, well, heavy-duty processing already. I didn't pick that prior at random. It's not pulled out of the sky. It reflects previous instances of having acquired information about nature or whatever. So what I want to do then is rank those probability distributions, and therefore the mechanism to select one here is going to be, among all of those that satisfy the constraint, pick the probability distribution that lies closest to the prior. Maximize that entropy subject to the appropriate constraints. So that's the selected probability distribution. And the interesting thing about this approach is that it definitely includes the usual maximum entropy method, where you maximize the Shannon entropy. It also includes the Bayes rule for updating when the information comes in the form of data. And it also includes all the theory of large deviations as special cases. So this is an interesting method for us.
So I have another question. Shouldn't posterior include prior?
If the updating, when the updating is in the form, is due to information in the form of data, what you recover
when you do it properly
is precisely the base rule for updating, so that the posterior includes the prior as a factor, if that's what you're asking.
But I mean, just that figure, it seems that there's a contradiction that mm-hmm. posterior and prior are not.
It's not, one has to be very careful about what the variable X is. When you're dealing with a typical Bayes problem, you have X representing data and theta representing the parameters you want to figure out.
Yeah.
When you put those two together, it still works.
Each point there, the whole
every point is a probability distribution, not a value of X. So this is a space of probability distributions.
No, I think he understood that. Yeah, yeah. So, no, it's a relevant question. It seems here that, well, I don't know.
I mean, but the probability is a number, so there's a two-dimensional space.
Oh, this is a super infinite dimensional space of all probability distributions. The point here is a probability distribution of the variable X, but it's not just a number.
Highest probability. Oh, okay. I see. Okay, I see.
It's in this sense.
Okay.
It's a whole probability distribution.
How did you get a constraint that had a sharp boundary like?
Oh, sometimes. Well, the constraint can be something like the expected value of a certain variable equals 3. And so all those probability distributions that satisfy the constraint are supposed to be somewhere here.
But how would you ever know that the expected value was exactly?
Oh, that's the piece of information. Where that information came from, that's another issue. But that's the piece of information that's being processed here. Someone told you, from now on, you're supposed to believe that the expected value is 3.
Okay,
and so that you update using this way. Maybe the person who told you is an experimentalist who has very good reasons to think, because they made measurements or something, that the expected value or the data or whatever is a certain number. And that's how you
So we solve idealization in some sense.
Yes, of course, yeah.
So can I interpret this as saying you've got prior information, Q of X, and now I've got one new piece of information, and this one new piece of information is allowing me to construct a new distribution.
That's right. And typically the piece of information that you acquire is not that selects a single new probability distribution, it may include a whole family of them. And so the question is, among all of those, which one you pick? So for example, if you're doing statistical mechanics, then the prior distribution could be a uniform distribution over phase space. The constraint that you put here is an expected value of the energy or an expected value of the number of particles. And the selected one would be the Boltzmann distribution or a Higgs distribution or something. Now, my point is to go over this quickly, because I'm going to be using exactly the same ideas to talk about quantum mechanics, not to talk about an equilibrium situation, but about a dynamical situation.
What if it's not unique? What if it's not unique? It's
not a problem. Ah, nice.
Let me see if I can go back.
Yeah. This ranking here is kind of nice, because although this is the preferred probability distribution, it doesn't mean that the neighboring probability distributions are ruled out. In fact, what one acquires when one applies the method in its full glory is you find a probability distribution over this region which goes like the exponential of the entropy. So that's why it really looks very much like the large deviation theory and the theory of fluctuations, that Einstein, the exponentials of the entropies are the probabilities of fluctuations around it. So in a sense, this is the preferred one because it's the one that's most probable, but there could be fluctuations and you could find yourself in the close vicinity. What happens if it's not unique? What happens if this shape is not strictly convex, right? If it has two bumps? Well, then you select two, no problem. Yeah. Okay.
So, sorry, what you're saying is just equivalent to Bayes' theorem, isn't it?
It includes Bayes' theorem as a special case. When the information that you get is in the form of data, as it is when you do Bayes' theorem,
okay,
it's a special case of the general procedure. So the statistical model. We're going to be talking about particles, and I'm going to concentrate throughout on a single particle. And I'm going to say that the particle lives in three-dimensional Euclidean configuration space. If you want to make it curved, that's fine. If you want to have more than one particle, that's fine too. This is configuration space. If you want to have 10 to the 23 particles, it works out well too. I'll just do it in one because it's simpler. So there is the configuration space. It's three-dimensional. There's the particle. It has a position. Now, the basic assumption I'm going to be making here is that there is some sort of uncertainty in the position of the particle. When I refer to the particle being at x, actually, the true position is somewhere in the vicinity of x. It's a y. And there is a little probability distribution there that tells me that I made a little mistake. That probability distribution, I call it small case p, y given x, and x could very possibly be just the expected value of the y's. So I'm going to be talking about x's. X's are the things that appear in the Schrödinger equation. But the real position of the particle is somewhere in its vicinity. This could be space-time foam or something that's shaking the particle or whatever. There is some intrinsic uncertainty going on in here. The actual functional form of this probability distribution doesn't matter much. If you want to think of them as Gaussians, that's fine. It's a good idea to think of them as being very, very, very narrow. I'm not even going to use that either. But in that case, what that means is that the y, the uncertainty that's going on here, the y different from the x, are very big.
Is the idea that x is the measured value and y is the true value?
Actually, if this is the y is the true value, then what you would measure ideally is the y.
So what's x?
X is an estimator for y.
Okay.
And if it's very, very narrow, it's a natural estimator. Okay, so that's the basic assumption. There is an uncertainty. That's difficult to observe directly. So here we have it. And so now, since we're going to be talking about these probability distributions a whole lot, it's convenient to think about them in more geometrical terms. So I'll think about all the possible probability distributions, P, that you have all over the place here. So we have a whole family of probability distributions, and I'm going to write it up like that. This is this space, this statistical manifold, is a space in which each point here represents a probability distribution. When the particle is out here, I could say that the estimated position is x. So x refers to a position. The same x up here is labeling the probability distribution. So it's a one-to-one correspondence between the x's here, which are positions, and the x's up there, which represent probability distribution. So that's
the model. Is this a simplifying assumption?
This is not an assumption.
I said it is a simplifying assumption. But could you have the probability distribution could have more than one parameter, more than just x? It could have other parameters.
Yes. Yes, in fact, that's the way we're trying to handle spin, and it's coming out very nicely, and I think we can do it. Have more than one value. Yes, one. Okay, very good. So there is the configuration space that has a metric. The metric is the Euclidean with a scale factor. This just tells you whether you're measuring things in centimeters or whatever. But the real reason to keep the sigma squared here is that when you're doing configuration space and you're tackling particles that have different masses, you don't want your configuration space to be isotropic, right? The dimensions that correspond to particle 1 have a certain sigma. The dimensions that correspond to particle 2 have a certain different sigma, sigma 1, sigma 2. This is an idea that was already introduced when people first started talking about the configuration spaces back in 1830 or so. I think it was Jacobi who first introduced this kind of asymmetry. And then there is a statistical manifold that allows me to think about all the possible probability distributions down here. Very good. The probability distributions need not be identical everywhere, right? So things could be narrower over here, broader over here. That's why this space, statistical manifold,
it's not nice and flat. It's actually curved. Very good. So now it's the dynamics. The particle moves from an x to a new x prime. Now, this is an important part. Neither x prime nor the y prime, neither the estimated x prime nor the true x y prime are actually known. So the relevant space in which I'm going to be doing the inference is x cross x. So what we're talking about is, what we're trying to figure out is the joint distribution of those two. That's what we seek to find. And so to find it, we're going to maximize a joint relative entropy given by that. So we're going to maximize this entropy to find P when there is a prior, and there are a bunch of posteriors, a bunch of constraints that we're going to have to put in there. Now, I'm being a little bit more careful here. This is the joint distribution in x prime and y prime when I start from x. Similarly, this is my prior probability distribution when I start from x and I land somewhere else. Now, this is the meat of the method. First, we have to find the prior, and then we have to stipulate the constraints. This is a very tricky part, figuring out the prior. And what I'm going to assume is that before I know anything, magical words, before I know anything, I know nothing. So what I'm going to assume is that before I know anything else, the particle starts at x, and it could end up at any x prime, any y prime. I'm going to choose that prior to be uniform. This is a non-trivial step, and it's very significant. I'll mention it a little bit more later. But now you say, no, wait a minute. We do know that the x and the y prime are not completely uncorrelated. If I expand this guy using the product rule as the probability of the first and then the probability of the second given the first, I know precisely how the y prime should actually be very close to the x prime. So the fact that the y's and the x's are connected to each other through those little p's is an important constraint. It's the constraint that tells me that I am moving on this statistical manifold. It tells me that whatever this piece is, this part is y prime given x prime. So that's the first constraint. The second constraint is that what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out how you jump from an x to an x prime. The second constraint is going to be that when you jump from an x somewhere else, you don't jump huge amounts. Physics tends to happen continuously. In other words, if you do find after a while that the particle is very far from where it started, the physical assumption I'm going to make is that the particle reached a long step by going through many intermediate short steps. So that continuity I'm going to invoke as a second constraint. I'm going to say that the expected value of the distance of the length of the step is something that is small. This is the second constraint. So the two constraints are the known relation between the true position and its expected value, and the fact that I only take short steps.
Are we supposed to think of this as a short time later after
time has not been introduced yet, and I'm going to have to talk about
it's
how it produces. In
it's a
principle,
long time, then that doesn't make sense.
What, exactly.
If it's a long time, then
this is something that's only, the short step is what's only going to make sense if I assume it is a short time. But I'm going to invert the argument. I am going to say, given that it was a very short step, to that I will associate a very short time. At this point, there is no time in the picture.
Question.
Yeah?
That first constraint is a Markov condition. It says that x and y prime are conditionally independent given x prime.
Yes.
So why should that be the case? It basically says if you tell me that the prime estimator you know, then learning the unprimed estimator doesn't help me identify the y prime. And so I'm just trying to figure out what you have.
Well, the constraint here is that, of course, what I'm trying to find out is you start from a point and you land somewhere else. What do you know? At this point, there is absolutely no assumption being made. This is true in general, right?
Yeah. Just the product rule for probability distributions.
So what I'm going to say now is that the relation between the y prime and the x's is
the original one that I started with in my model. The model is such that
if I tell you what the x prime is,
the y prime is determined to be within its vicinity, quite irrespective of where you start. It ends up being a Markovian condition, of course, but it's part of what the model is.
So this is just Brownian motion, I guess.
Eventually it gets to that, yes. And that's one of the interesting features of this, how it is that Brownian motion actually does represent quantum mechanics.
So the result of this is that the transition probability from x to x prime includes the entropy, a Lagrange multiplier that implements the... Let me just put it right here. It includes the entropy of those p probability distributions that specify the statistical manifold, and then there is a Lagrange multiplier, and then there is the distance, that the length of the step. There are three pieces to this. To this probability distribution. The first piece is that I used a flat prior, a uniform prior. Had I chosen something different because maybe my configuration space was curved or something like that, that would have entered here, multiplying all of that. So that's over there. That first piece says that the particle could jump anywhere. The second piece tells me that if I move from the original x to P that is in its vicinity, I'm going to go to the one that has the most entropy, right? I'm going to try to go in the direction of P distributions that are product. Of course, you don't want to go by a huge amount. That's what the third piece is saying, that if you travel by a large delta L, when alpha is positive, you're going to kill that probability distribution. So this is the dynamics for short steps. That's the entropic piece, and then that's the short step part. Very good. For large alpha, which corresponds to short steps, one can approximate that by a Gaussian distribution, where you, this is the delta x, the jump, and the jump is centered about an expected value. So the displacement delta x can be separated into two pieces, an expected amount and a fluctuation. The expected drift is going to be something that has to do with the gradient of the entropy. So this means that this particle tends to move in the direction of increasing entropy. And there are fluctuations. And the quadratic fluctuations go like 1 over alpha, while the average displacement goes like 1 over alpha as well. So it is here that we see that this is really resembling a Brownian motion. The expected drift is like 1 over alpha, while the expected fluctuation is 1 over the square root of alpha, so that the trajectory in the limit of very large alpha tends to be continuous, but not differential. So after a single step, this is what we have. We start with a configuration space. There is a little bit of uncertainty about the position x. Then there is this statistical manifold of all the probability distributions. The corresponding p y of x is up there. And when I jump to x prime, there is a Gaussian probability distribution about it. And I can either write it down there or up there. It's the same Gaussian that operates on both. This is after a single step. So now what I want to go do, I want to do the full dynamics now. And what I'm going to start doing is iterating these little steps, step by step, so that out of many small steps, I can create a long one. So the result's going to be something. And this is going to be a probability distribution rho of x. So what we want now is we want the result of iterating those short steps to produce the probability distribution rho. Now, how do we do that? This is a fair amount of bookkeeping that's required here. So this is step 3 in this procedure, which is
they introduced the introduction of time as a bookkeeping device to keep track of how these short steps accumulate. Now, so far, I've talked about the probability of a short step. I haven't mentioned time. So far, it has been pure inference. If the particle is here and there is a jump, never mentioned whether the jump was towards the future or towards the past or towards anything. It's completely timeless. There is no time in this. Entropic arguments or Bayesian arguments of any sort do not include time at all. Now I have to be honest about it and say where it is that time comes into this picture. Now, when I do this, it's fairly clear that after a few steps, even if I knew precisely where I had started at x, after a few steps, not only I do not know the x prime, I also do not know the x double prime, right? I'm completely confused about both the initial and the final step. And so, let me see, pause. Time is traversable. So I want to accumulate these small steps, and the foundation of the notion of time that I'm going to introduce here is the dynamics. So the only piece of information that I really have in this business is what happens when you do a short step, the piece we complete. So we're going to say, since I do not know either the beginning or the end, the object that I'm really interested in is the joint probability of x and x prime. And if I marginalize over x, what I get is the probability of x prime. There is no assumption here. This is just the way probability distributions work. Nothing prevents me from using the product rule for probability distributions and separating it in this way. Again, no assumptions here. But this actually does show where I can introduce an assumption. The one thing we know about what happens with this conditional probability distribution is when I'm taking a very short step. In that circumstance, if this probability distribution refers to one instant in time, then it is not unreasonable to assume that this will refer to the next instant in time. Big assumption about what I mean by time here. I'm constructing time. So essentially what I'm doing here is I am introducing a notion of what I mean by an instant. It's not just one initial position and one final position. It's a whole probability distribution that refers to what I mean by an instant. When I talk about px, I am going to make the assumption that the different values of x are at the same time. So I'm defining what an instant there is. And I'm going to write this as follows. This guy is this one here, and I'm going to call that time t. And when I do one step, I'm going to call that at t prime, slightly later. Given one instant, I figure out the next. Given the next one, the next again, and so on. What this means is that I'm now capable of building time instant by instant.
Haven't you just introduced a discrete time, basically? I don't see.
It's not
discrete. I don't see what's gained by this sort of indirect way of talking about it. You really have a sequence of random variables, and or whatever you want to call these things, these x's and x primes and so on.
The sequence is introduced by virtue of this inference process where I actually ask the question, given one position, what's the next one, and then what's the next one, and what's the next one. And that is what's built in the sequence. Whether we want to call that time or not is, but it's immaterial at this point. It's just purely inferential.
That's logical time or something.
Could be. Yes.
You're doing the inference that starts the future, not time. You could do inference that starts the past too, but that's not what.
No. It could be. If you wanna measure positive times going into the past, that would work as well. It's being constructed.
At this point, it's just
topological, it just gives you an order.
It gives you an order, exactly. Exactly, yes. So we have what I call an instant, we have a next instant, and so on. And now we would like to introduce a notion of an interval of time, a distance between successive instants. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to define the interval of time between successive instants as determined by tuning this Lagrange multiplier alpha that gives me the length of the steps. This is where the actual length of time is going to come in. In fact, for large alpha or short steps, I have actually mentioned that the actual transition probability looks very much like a Gaussian type. So what I'm going to define is, I'm going to define the duration delta t so that the motion looks simple. It's arbitrary as it gets. I'll define it so that it looks simple. And I'm going to define it in such a way that, first of all, it's independent alpha of x. The Lagrange multiplier that determines the length of those steps is independent of position. So that whatever I am assuming about the steps over here, they're going to be the same as the steps over here in the limit of small alpha, and that this time is going to evolve equally in all positions. Yeah.
Supposing you wanted to generalize this to some curved space-time or something, would you still make it?
I'm working right now on the this is going to be non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, so what I'm trying to reproduce here is Newtonian quantum mechanics. So what I'm trying to do is Newtonian time. But it would be very, very interesting to actually try to assume, suppose I want to do Newtonian gravity. Wouldn't it be interesting to say that time flows at different rates up here than down there and introduce it there? I don't know if it works, but this is one of the things. Yeah. Very good. The result of all of this is a Wiener process. So the Gaussian becomes something like this. The displacement is the result of a velocity drift multiplied by delta t and the fluctuation. The drift velocity ends up being the gradient of the entropy with... Oh, I forgot to mention. I should just go back because this tau is going to show up a little bit more. Alpha is inversely proportional to delta t. And there is a constant there. That's just a constant fixing the units. It's not particularly important, except that when you want to do things right, you have to worry about what units you're using. If you want to use seconds, you use one tau. If you want to use minutes, it's a different tau. The tau will show up later. So this is what you get. The drift velocity is proportional to the gradient of the entropy. And the fluctuations are proportional to delta t. Yeah, sure.
So what's the direction of time for you?
There is no direction of time. The direction of time is the direction of inference here. I define time everywhere I want. I go from 1x to the x prime by a process of maximum entropy, right? I maximize that joint entropy. So essentially, this is entropic time. It has a direction. It is the direction in which I'm increasing that joint entropy.
Yeah, but there's still, if you really had nothing, no background time or anything to refer to, it could be that the first three steps were going forward in time, the fifth and sixth were going backward, the seventh was going forward. That would not be equivalent to just breaking a symmetry.
No.
Completely different time.
There is a sense in which this theory is timeless in the sense of Barbour. There is a bunch of instants. And they, in principle, don't come with any ordering. It is the inference process that sets up the ordering in figuring out which instant is most like the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one.
No, but so you had an input that there would be small steps. So
yeah, the steps, each
in,
one.
That's building in.
Each one is a small step from the previous one.
Yeah.
If I go back to your first slide, though, you had a prior,
yes.
And you had a constraint, which was new information. Does that not establish the direction of time? Because actually you've got more information.
This, well...
And is that not essential?
I'm defining time, and if I want to use my word time in that sense, yes, no problem.
But there is also a sense in which, when you're doing inference, you can do inferences about the past.
But you have no new information in that case. So that what was interesting about that is I've got a prior, and now I've got some new information, so I'm looking for my new probability distribution, given my new information. So that implies that, you know, there's been some measurement, and something that allows me to add some information to give me a new prior. A new
But it doesn't necessarily mean that this means that there is a physical time that's going forward. You could actually have acquired information about what happened in ancient Rome, and you can actually make inferences about the past as well. So what this does is it orders things. Whether it orders them according to a physical time or orders them forward or backward, doesn't show.
If I think of adding information to my prior, even though that information might have been about Rome but past, that's new information that I have now, which gives me a new prior on which I can base further predictions. So I'm not going to be predicting, new things happen. I'll gain new information. I'll inform my prior about the past, but my direction of time is still...
Your direction of inference.
My direction of inference is
based on
how much information I have.
But what new information do you have? X prime could be anywhere. You have no information about where it is.
I think that in this process there is a direction of inference. That's why I call it entropic time, because it doesn't assume that there is an underlying physical time in the process.
If you don't identify it with physical time, you won't get the right Schrodinger equation.
Well,
I mean, you could say maybe the
time that appears in the Schrodinger equation is not so much a physical time, but an inferential time. Since I'm going to get the Schrodinger equation, it's going to be, well, let's proceed. So there is a well-known mechanism to actually iterate this process instant by instant, and that leads to the Fokker-Planck equation, which can be rewritten as a continuity equation. So there is nothing particularly fundamental about saying that probabilities obey a conservation law. What is interesting there is that the velocity is written as, apart from some constants, as the gradient of a function. Now, those of you who are familiar with the stochastic mechanics of Nelson will see that this is becoming very, very close to it. And indeed, it is. The more I get closer to the Schrodinger equation, of course, this ends up looking more and more like the David Bohm approach, the Nelson approach. It looks more and more like any of those approaches. There are two big differences with the Nelson stochastic mechanics approach. One of them is that he's trying to approach the problem of quantum mechanics through a realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics, while this is purely inferential. So this is one sort of philosophical distinction. Another big difference is that Nelson assumes that the velocity is a gradient of a function, while I have just derived it from the method maximum. Yes, you're really comfortable.
You introduced x as the actual position,
didn't you? The expected position.
Well, I forget. You had an x and a y.
Yes.
One of them you said was the real value.
The real value is y. Yes.
So, I mean...
But it's very close.
Yes, I know, but you just said now... Sorry, I've forgotten your exact word. You said it wasn't like Nelson's
interpretation. The mathematics looks... Mathematics looks very, very,
but
very
Nelson
much...
is. Sorry, I've forgotten exactly how you put it. But I thought you said something.
Well,
like
Nelson.
And why sounds really like a hidden variance to me? You didn't use the phrase hidden variance.
Yeah, I didn't. But I have no problem with saying that there are hidden variables.
No, okay. It just sounded as though you were saying the word. Sorry, I
Question.
Yeah.
Is y the actual value changing in time?
I don't know. I mean, presumably it is, because y is always very close to the corresponding x, and the x is sort of evolving in some peculiar way, right, according to this law. But I don't know what's going on with the y. It's the x's that I'm sort of interested in. I hope that, because these probability distributions are very narrow, that the actual position of the particle is really, really close to it. So it's probably, my best guess is that it's going to be some x somewhere.
So I'm confused, though, because if it was just an inference problem, that I could imagine saying there's some y, and now I start giving you clue after clue about what y is, various constraints. So like maybe it's a position on the globe, and my first constraint is it's within 5 kilometers of a lake.
I'm not even addressing the problem of y directly. I'm trying to figure out what the estimator of y is. So in a sense, that's what I'm trying to do. What is the x? And this x, once I keep doing more and more constraints on it,
right.
This x, the distribution for x, is evolving in a certain way.
But so I'm still very confused, because I can imagine if y were fixed, that you get more and more clues, and over time you refine your knowledge about what y was.
That's not what I'm doing.
So now if I think y could be changing, then why take into account any of that prior information? You know, like, unless I know something about the
you don't.
Nature of the change.
You don't take any of that prior information. The prior is being reset to uniform at every little step. So you're not taking whatever happened earlier was for a different y, or a different x. What I'm doing now is for an x prime and a y prime. That's different. And in a after a few more steps, it's a double primes that are going to be the issue. So
have a small step condition that in effect takes into account the previous.
It takes the previous x. That's
the information on y.
That's the one thing that remains. Yeah.
So why is the previous estimator, why should I assume it has any information about the new actual location? If I know nothing about how the new actual location is related to the old actual location, the old estimator might have told me something about the old location. And why should the old estimator bear at all on the new location?
The prior is that it bears, in principle, it has nothing to do with it. But then I have two constraints. The particle had to move, right? And it could only move a short step. So that's where it keeps some memory of what's actually going on. And that's all there is to it. Okay, what is this function phi? This is the velocity with which probabilities flow, the current velocity. What is that function phi? Well, it has to do with the entropy of those probability distributions, p, and it has to do with the logarithm of rho. So there are two pieces to it. There is the drift velocity, which is like the gradient of the entropy. The particle tends to move, the probability distribution rho tends to move along the entropy gradient, and there is this so-called osmotic velocity. So the particle tends to move in the direction of increasing entropy, and as probabilities tend to accumulate a lot there, it tends to slide back due to this additional piece here. This piece here, if you just take the rho that's there and you put it up there, you see that the diffusion current, rho u, is, well, like the gradient of rho. So this is very much like Fick's law of diffusion, where this is a diffusion coefficient. So there are two terms to the flow of probability. Now, this is just diffusion. This is not quantum mechanics. This is just Brownian motion trajectories. This is what you get when. So what is it that's going on here that's wrong? Well, a wave function requires 2 degrees of freedom. Not just rho, but also a phase. So let's figure out what's going on when we are in this scheme of diffusion that I was thinking of before. Suppose that I were to take this function phi that appears in the velocity, the current velocity propagates like a gradient of phi, and it's the entropy minus log rho. Can we take this as a phase? Well, one thing that's obvious is that this is not a second degree of freedom. To each probability distribution here, I assign an entropy, and this is fixed, static. As far as this formula here is concerned, if this rho is a degree of freedom, well, this phi is essentially equivalent to that rho. It's not a new degree of freedom. So this is what this is telling us is that, yeah, indeed, this is just diffusion. It's not quantum mechanics. So how can we solve this problem? How can we introduce a true new dynamical degree of freedom? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use an idea that smells a little bit of relativity, The diffusion here occurs like in the direction of the gradient of the entropy. So the geometry of this space here is guiding the direction in which the particle is diffusing. Now, the idea that I'm going to borrow from general relativity is that while it is true that this space guides the motion of the particles, it does not seem like the particles are reacting back on the space. The space here is rigid, it's fixed, it's a fixed pattern. So that's the part that we're going to relax now. We're not going to use that phase, that phi, as a phase. What I'm going to allow is this statistical manifold to be a dynamical entity. So that as this probability distribution diffuses, then this space reacts, moves, that's whatever, it changes. And so now the actual phi is going to be itself a function of time, second degree of freedom. So next problem we have to tackle is, what do we use for the dynamics of this space? What is it that defines the dynamics of that space? What is the manifold dynamics? And for this, we're going to impose the conservation of a certain quantity that I'm going to call energy. This is an idea that I'm borrowing from Nelson in 79 and Smolin cleaned it up in 2006. The idea is that as there is a functional E of rho, it's an expected value, which includes the velocities that have appeared in this picture. One is the current velocity, another is the osmotic velocity. I'm going to include a potential. I'm interested in the low velocities, non-relativistic limits. So I'm going to take the lowest order terms in the velocities, squares, and there are a bunch of constants floating around. So, yeah.
So I got lost at some, I've lost some fact.
Yeah.
When you had this entropy S.
Yes.
What determined it? I thought it was some sort of relative distance.
Oh, no, that's it. There are two entropies in
this.
Where did
this S come from?
This S here is the S that goes with the little piece. Py dyx log pyx. Not to be confused with the other joint entropy, which is the entropy that I wrote in the very beginning. Two entropies. This is the entropy of the little piece. This is a scalar field on this statistical manifold M. Okay.
So we would expect it to be constant in a flat space.
In a flat space, it would be uniform. Yes, uniform. Yes. If in a non-flat space, then it changes. And here it changes even with time because I'm assuming that this statistical manifold M is just moving around, flat in the wind. So what are these constants A and B? Let me just rename that constant A as M. From the gamma here, there is a sigma squared, and I just renamed it as something like that. It is even more further convenient to rephrase this constant A in terms of a new constant eta that connects the mass units with the energy units. And this is the same tau that appear that define the units of time. So this is just a change in units and being cautious about it. So eventually things look like sharing.
Sorry, what was U?
U is the osmotic velocity, the diffusion velocity. It has to do with the fact that the probabilities tend to go in the direction of increasing entropy. But when the probability increases too much, it just slides back. It's against the gradient of rho. OK, very good. So what's that mu? That mu there, that other constant, we can rewrite it in this way. And there is an interesting, so that M, I'm just going to call that mass. It's a constant that appears in that energy. And this guy here sometimes is called the osmotic mass. Now, a remarkable feature that's going to come in handy in a little while is that if I were to change units appropriately, then U changes. And that change can always be reabsorbed into mu. So I can always tweak things in such a way that this osmotic mass equals the inertial mass. For a while now, however, I'm going to keep calling it mu because...
But I don't understand, because they're both velocities, aren't they?
Yeah, they're both velocities.
U and V are both velocities. So how will change in units allow you to change the ratio between M and mu?
One of them includes phi, and the other just includes rho. So I can incorporate that change in units into the phi, reabsorb it there. It's a matter of just reshuffling things around. Just the instance. It works. In fact, okay. Now that we're talking about it, this guy goes like the logarithm of rho, right? The gradient of the logarithm of rho. This, we call this a velocity, but the truth is that this guy here is changes under t goes to minus t. This changes sign, but this one doesn't. So it is much more appropriate to call this or think of this as being a kinetic energy, while this really is like a potential energy. This is what in the David Bohm approach looks like the quantum potential. So that's the point. So it's not quite a velocity, although the units are units. Okay, the result is two coupled equations. One is the Fokker-Planck diffusion equation, just an equation of continuity. The other one is the energy conservation plus diffusion leads to an equation like this. This equation here tells how phi regulates the propagation of rho, how the entropy that's hiding here tells how rho changes, while this equation here tells how rho regulates the evolution of phi. So here we have the statistical manifold telling how rho evolves, and here we have the distribution rho saying how it is that the statistical manifold changes. And this is it. We can always combine rho and phi into something complex. Nothing prevents you from doing that. And when you do that, what one gets is a Schrödinger equation where eta plays the role of the Planck constant with an additional term. And this additional term is the one that's kind of interesting, because if you can choose things such that mu equals m, it disappears. Interestingly enough, the appearance of the equation as it is here, when you haven't chosen your units appropriately, you haven't regraduated things appropriately, the equation is nonlinear. And the appearance of complex numbers, which were just introduced by Hand here, does not seem particularly fundamental. What is fundamental about complex numbers in quantum mechanics is not that you can combine rho and phi into psi. What is fundamental is the fact that the resulting equation depends only on psi and not on psi and its complex conjugate. You can always combine two things into a complex number. That you can always do. It's not particularly deep. The thing is, when you combine it, you only have psi, not psi and psi star. But if you can actually regraduate things and find a more convenient description that makes those two equal, then you recover linearity, and complex numbers have a nice proper role that they have in quantum mechanics. Okay. Before I end, just one more example. Suppose you describe a certain physical situation with a certain number of constraints that presumably collect the relevant information for that physical situation. What if you find a situation where you need more constraints? So suppose that now, in addition to the first constraint that told me the connection between these two, the relation between those two, and the second constraint that told me that when you actually move, you're not going to move by very long steps, just very short steps. Suppose I add a third constraint that says that the component of the displacement along a particular direction, the expected value is some sort of constant. Suppose I have that additional constraint. Interesting. Note that this constraint here is the one that tells you that you tend to move along the gradient of the entropy. it tells you something about the direction you're going to tend to move. This constraint here also tells you about the direction you tend to move. It says that a component in a particular direction tends to be a certain amount. So there is a sense in which these two constraints are not completely independent of each other. Somehow they contain both pieces of the same information. Let's see what happens with all this. When you put the third constraint, you have to introduce yet another Lagrange multiplier. So this is exactly the same probability, transition probability distribution we had before. You tend to move in the direction of increasing entropy, but you don't move very far away. And then this is the Lagrange multiplier that regulates that particular constraint. The game now proceeds exactly as before, with exactly the same energy and everything. And the result is now that the velocity is the gradient of the function phi, the same function as before, with an additional piece. And this leads to a Schrödinger equation where you have that additional piece. So this allows us to see that if you were to do experiments based on making predictions with this equation, the Lagrange multiplier would turn out to be the electric charge divided by hc, which tells you that in this approach, the electric charge is interpreted as a Lagrange multiplier that regulates the strength of the response of the particle to a particular field A, which restricts components of the motion along that direction. Furthermore, you see that the structure here is one in which you do have a gauge invariance. So in this model, in this entropic model, gauge invariance reflects a symmetry, of course, like all gauge invariances. And here, it's a symmetry between information codified into the first and the third constraint. The physically relevant information for this kind of problem can be either put into the first constraint, or it can be put into the third constraint. You can put a little bit of here and a little bit there. How you manage to do it, it doesn't matter. That's the symmetry. Two different agents with different information would assign different probability distributions and therefore make different predictions. They would probably also assign different values to that field, that external potential, and they would make different predictions. But if you tweak that appropriately and you tweak this appropriately, the predictions are going to be compatible with each other. That's the gauge symmetry. It's an inferential explanation or interpretation of the gauge symmetry. So, conclusion. On the laws of physics versus laws of nature, entropic inference can lead to laws of physics. This does not mean that maybe that there aren't laws of nature out there that physics mimics them, but how would you know? Entropic inference leads you to those laws in the same way. This is an alternative to the action principle. It's just entropic inference. And the time that one obtains here, whatever I call time, is irreversible in the sense that it is always obtained by this process of maximizing an entropy. It only goes in one direction. If there is anything that is worth remembering from the whole talk, before you actually, hopefully, study what it is that I've said here, is that in this approach, the phase of the wave function receives a statistical interpretation. The usual vision of quantum mechanics we have is that the magnitude of the wave function receives a statistical interpretation by the Born rule. In this approach, the phase is also statistically interpreted, both in terms of rho and the entropy. And that if we were to summarize the main results here, is that the wave function, just collect those guys here, is some funny object, rho, times the exponential of an entropy. And of course, the moment that you have an interpretation for the entropy, for the phase, these transformations need to be appropriately rethought as well. Thank you very much.
So what is the equation that governs entropy?
The what?
The equation that governs the evolution of S.
Okay, let me see. Here. It's these equations here, the two coupled equations. This tells you, this S in that F, in that phi, right? This tells you how the rho changes. And this equation here tells you how, given the rho, it tells you how the phi is changing. But phi is connected to the entropy. So this is the equation that tells you.
Where does this second equation come from?
It comes from the energy conservation equation. Energy conservation. As rho changes, if this is to remain fixed, then the entropy that's hiding in here has to change as well. So there is a balance here when rho appears here, and of course a little bit in there as well. As those rhos change, the entropy that appears here has to change appropriately.
But that's a global constant. I just don't see how you can get a local equation.
Oh, okay. The local equation arises when you actually do it. That this energy conservation has to hold no matter what the distribution rho is. So it should hold for arbitrary choices of rho and of rho dot. So that's what makes it global. This is not supposed to, energy is not supposed to work just for one particular choice of rho. It's supposed to work for any choices of rho you can come up with, and that's what allows them to make it work.
So it's stronger than energy conservation?
Well, it's energy conservation for any initial condition. Yeah.
What happens to the gauge invariance if you don't tune out the osmotic mass?
Let me see. Nothing. It remains there. And the reason it remains there is that the actual expression for the velocity does not contain the osmotic mass. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's still there. In fact, let me continue with this a little bit more here. This is the equation that follows from that energy conservation condition. You can actually see here that eta phi, if I were to define a quantity a quantity S Hamilton Jacobi, which is h bar phi, right? The Hamilton Jacobi function. That equation there, that piece, is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And this additional piece here is what corresponds to the quantum potential. If I allow eta to go to zero, I recover the classical limit. So this approach includes F equals ma in the classical limit. Properly, yes, no, of course, as you should. But there is another interesting possibility here, which is that how about if you don't let eta h bar go to zero. You don't let h bar go to zero. So this is supposedly quantum. But you put mu equal to zero. You get rid of this again. So this would be a situation where you have a statistical theory, Brownian motion, with uncertainties, with an uncertainty principle and everything else, where the equation doesn't have a quantum potential, and it's the particles tend to move with fluctuations along the classical trajectories. So that would be a situation where you have a theory that's sort of intermediate between quantum mechanics and classical physics, with fluctuations, but classical trajectories. And if you were to generalize it and do electricity and magnetism with it, you would also, it would be gauge invariant.
Well, why is it intermediate as opposed to just being a sort of classical theory?
Because it would be a statistical theory. It would not be. It would not be
a statistical classical
theory. A statistical classical theory with an uncertainty principle. That's what's kind of interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, an uncertainty principle there. In fact, there are ideas of Marcel Reginato and Michael Hall, in which what they try to take advantage of ideas like this to say, maybe you could take a quantum mechanical object and make it interact with another object that's not quite totally quantum mechanical because mu is zero for it. So you could have situations where you have quantum mechanical objects interacting with this statistical classical object in a consistent way. So this is various things to be tried.
I mean, you haven't said anything about the uncertainty principle.
No, I haven't. I didn't think I had time, and indeed I don't have time. But I can tell you.
Say the other differences. I mean, presumably this is not local for the one part.
Oh, of course. Well, the moment that the theory is formulated in configuration space,
yeah,
like Schrödinger noticed back then, it's completely non-local and there are entanglement situations.
But in the Bohm theory, non-locality comes from the quantum potential. If you don't have a quantum potential there,
It would include the non-local correlations that arise from formulating a theory in configuration space. Those would be there. What would not be, maybe, is the fact that if you make the particle go through two slits, interference effects would be lost. Yes. The interference effects, the funny interference effects that arise from going through two slits, they're contained here. Those would disappear. But all sorts of non-locality would not.
I was wondering if you could clarify for me on the assumptions you made at the very beginning. Which ones are statements about reality? Which ones are statements about what we know about reality?
Okay.
Maybe if you went back to the overhead with your three assumptions, we could point that point. Because in particular, I'm confused about whether this short step is a statement about how why the actual position changes over time, or whether it's a statement about how my knowledge changes over time.
The statement, there is one feature of this which is very, very unlike what we're all used to thinking when we're doing Bayesian data analysis. When you're doing Bayesian data analysis, you're trying to determine a parameter theta, and you collect data. And all the data you collect reflects more and more and more and more information about the parameter you're trying to determine, right? Okay, this is nothing like that. The way this works is I know that particles, in principle, the next step is going to be anywhere I want, anywhere. I don't know where it's going. That's the prior. But then I say,
so the next step of the actual position, or the next step of the estimator, which is the description of my knowledge of the position. But what is stepping?
Both are stepping, okay? Because the if the estimator changes, then presumably, if I have the correct relevant information for the problem, the y is not going to be completely uncorrelated with the x. However, the information that I have is about the correlators, the estimator x, that doesn't move by very much. So it is a purely inferential. It is about my knowledge about what's actually going on.
This is information about something that represents information about something.
Yes.
I mean.
Yes. Exactly.
You say you have information about x, and x represents.
The x changes by a little bit, and presumably, the y, the real y, is following close, but I don't know.
Is y actually playing any role in this? I mean, it plays a role when you derive it. You assume a p.
Entropy.
Sure. Entropy. After that, you're always talking about distributions over x.
That's absolutely true. But this field, this scalar field on the statistical manifold M, this scalar field represents the entropy of the y's. So this is the one place where.
But you could just get rid of the y's and just consider that function s. I mean.
That's right. And then you would lose the interesting interpretation that what's driving all of this is an entropy. Yeah. But you could, yes.
There was a question back
there. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, I wanted to know if you tried talking about measurements in this way.
I haven't, but I have two things to say. Nelson started doing his stochastic mechanics sometime in 1967 or so. And in the middle 80s, right after he wrote his book, he found out that when you do stochastic mechanics, which is very similar to this, but it reflects a realistic attempt to describe quantum mechanics, he found that he could not, the particular case of repeated measurements would not be well described by stochastic mechanics in the sense that they didn't agree with what you would get using just regular quantum mechanics. And so he essentially gave up on stochastic mechanics. A couple of years later, two or three guys, Blanchard and Golden, and I don't know, someone else, it escapes me, they figured out that you could actually modify stochastic mechanics when you're doing repeated measurements by introducing a somewhat weird rule. And if you did that, then it would be in complete agreement with quantum mechanics. It turns out that the weird rule that these guys were proposing was Bayesian. In other words, once you recognize that what we're doing is inference, processing information, then the problems that Nelson had found with his realistic stochastic mechanics get fixed. So, while I have not yet done it, I have strong hopes that this will work okay too. I don't know.
If I understood, roughly speaking, entropy is identified with phase of the wave function.
Except for the log row. Yeah.
Except for this.
Yeah.
But of course, the phase is always changing in the solution. So that means that your probability distribution, little p, is always changing.
That's why the statistical manifold is changing, yes. And it's changing in particular.
It's very obscure what that means physically. I think it's related to the fact, at least it's obscure to me what it means physically, that why it would change. Why would the conditional probability of finding a particle at y,
why would it change?
Given that the estimator is x, why would that be changing in some very peculiar way?
I don't know hypothesis.
But if we see
probabilities in this approach, this inferential approach, probabilities are not physical objects. They reflect our knowledge about things. And in the same way, entropies are not physical objects.
Why would our knowledge?
Why would it change is a good question that I will not answer, except to say that once one accepts the assumption that this energy is conserved, then it implies that it changes. Now, why would energy be conserved?
Why should that particular? That seems like a very strong physics input that has nothing to do with inference. And somehow the dog is buried there.
It's 50% of the dog. It's 50% of the dog. The other 50% is that the velocity is like the gradient of a function. That's 50%. The other 50% is the entropy, the energy conservation law. Now, of course, it bothers me. But what I have to remember all the time is that what this is non-relativistic quantum mechanics. One can't expect a non-relativistic theory to be beautiful and perfect in all its aspects, right? Presumably, if one ever manages to find a much better theory that incorporates general relativity, then I would have a better idea of what the energy is. But at this point, I can't do that. In fact, I could almost change the argument and say, if it were the case that with absolutely crystal clear assumptions, I managed to derive non-relativistic quantum mechanics, I would almost certainly be capable of saying that it must be wrong. Because if the assumptions are so deep and fundamental, I should have gotten general relativity, right?
Well, the energy is going to become really problematic in general.
It's not going to be energy there. In general relativity, it's going to be something else. Local conservation of something or other, or
it's going to be something local because you have a whole...
But this was local, that's the thing.
It is local, but then in general relativity also, remember the Newtonian time? Maybe for general relativity, you have to choose alphas that depend on position or not.
Next year I'll tell you. Right now, I don't know.
Another question about reality, knowledge of reality. The final Schrodinger equation you write down, you write down an energy, it has a velocity term in it. That's the rate of change of x, the estimator. Is that correct? The velocity term.
The v term.
Yeah.
Is the velocity of the current. The current velocity. It's the velocity that shows up in the conservation law for rho.
Which tells me how my estimator should change. Is that accurate or not?
It tells you V has two pieces. One of them is the drift velocity, which is the expected change of the estimator, and then it has another piece, which is the osmotic velocity, which tells you how the diffusion works. So that V is not quite the velocity of the particle. In the classical limit, it is.
So yeah. I guess I'm wondering why that term is called energy at all, because Y is the position of particles. So if you looked at the rate of change of Y, you might say, well, that's
don't call it energy. Don't call it. Don't call
it change of X. So you agree, it's not really an energy because it's a change of some description of my knowledge, not a change of something in reality. So in that case, why should it be conserved?
Good question.
Okay.
In fact, maybe we shouldn't call it energy. It's related to this problem here. We shouldn't call it energy because, after all, what is energy? Energy is whatever is conserved as the result of translation invariance in time, right? Once you have a dynamics, energy is what is conserved when you do translation invariance in time. But we don't have dynamics here. I'm trying to invent a dynamics, right? So the only reason I called it energy is because do we really know what energy is? Is it green and goopy and sticks to things and they start shaking? I don't know. What is the real energy? Once I got the Schrodinger equation, I would invert the argument around and say, oh, you know what? That must have been energy. That's. In fact, this energy here corresponds to the expected value. Keep losing my chalks. That energy that appeared there, E, is what, if you were to write it, you know, work from the Schrodinger equation backwards and try to figure out what the E is the expected value of this. So that's what that E is. So is that real energy? Doesn't this reflect our knowledge about what's going on rather than reality?
Well, it relies on the conservation of probability. I mean, that's what you
Yeah.
you conserve.
That's right. Yes. So nothing is real here. It's just epistemology.
It's the Newtonian energy of the system.
Hmm?
It's the Newtonian energy of the system.
I don't know what energy is. I use this word that, you know, if something is conserved and it looks like energy and smells like energy and stuff, I call it energy.
You assumed it was conserved. You didn't derive it.
I supposed it was conserved and derived the Schrodinger equation. Yes, yeah.
Back to this energy thing. Shouldn't there be something there should be some sort of interpretation saying that something about your knowledge is conserved. Like, I don't know.
What probabilities are conserved?
Probabilities were already conserved earlier on. And
yeah,
this is another condition on your knowledge, which you
oh,
say is. There should be some interpretation as to you're constraining your knowledge to do something.
Absolutely.
It would be interesting to see what it is you're constraining your knowledge.
I hope that when I do this kind of approach in more fundamental theories, like maybe in general relativity, something will emerge showing me that in some non-relativistic limit, there is a quantity there that smells like energy that is conserved. But at this point, these are the ingredients, the assumptions that go into the formalism. These are the constraints, the pieces of information that go there. These are my principles. And from there, I derive the conclusions. Where are those? It's good to engage in some Marxist philosophy here. I like this one. It goes like this. These are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others. Right? It's Groucho Marx. Okay. At this point, sorry, these are my principles. And see, it's amazing that one can actually get things that we believe are deep physics, laws of nature, as being inference
from principles, well, from some principles. Now the question becomes, okay, where do those principles come from? Yeah. And I can't tell you better. Yeah.
So in terms of intuition, and you can correct me, it seems to me that, I mean, you started with Brownian motion in some external field, apparently, and this is like your entropy field. I mean, that this physical analog of that would be exactly that. But then somehow you decided that energy should be conserved, so you basically, your external field is set by the motion of the particle itself. So in a sense, you introduce a kind of self-force for this.
You got it.
And with the condition that energy is conserved. So if it was just a Brownian motion in external field, energy wouldn't be conserved. But then you said because external field is generated by the particle itself, then the energy.
So this is a funny kind of Brownian motion.
Yeah.
This is what Nelson called conservative diffusion. We typically associate diffusion to dissipative processes, right? And these processes are dissipative in the sense that there is some entropy that's constantly increasing. Yeah. In that sense, it is dissipative, but not in the sense that it dissipates energy. Yeah. So these are funny diffusion processes. Yeah. I didn't have to use it. Although.